Welcome to SLA, where you can learn to avoid gaslighting yourself and your language teaching practices,
break down academic gatekeeping on second language acquisition,
and girl boss your way through dynamic, engaging, and research-based language teaching.
I'm Ben Fisher Rodriguez, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Bill Langley, and my pronouns are he, him.
I'm Brian Smith, and my pronouns are he, they.
Let's slay.
Welcome back to another episode of SLA, Second Language Acquisition for Everyone. Today, we're going to be talking a bit about observations and how they might affect you in your classroom. We've got a fun article to discuss, and yeah, we're going to get into it. So when people hear the word observations, their heart rate might elevate or start beating a little bit faster, because that's usually part of your job when, you know, one of your administrators comes into the room and checks out what you're doing in there and, you know, got their little clipboard taking notes on what's going on. And people have had many kinds of experiences with observations, a few possibly positive, many neutral, and some definitely negative. And so I think it's something that's on a lot of teachers' minds. And, you know, really, when you say observations, though, it is not necessarily only about your administrator, because anyone really can observe a class. So we'll be getting into that a little bit later as well. But I'm going to be starting us out with gaslight. My name is Brian, if you don't know. And we're going to be talking about kind of experiences that we've had with observations that maybe didn't slay and kind of, yeah, pitfalls that we can fall into surrounding that. So, yeah, is there anything that's front of mind that's coming up for either of you about observations?
I've been thinking about how I feel pretty lucky. I've had some pretty excited observers who just come and are like soaking up how different a comprehension based language class can be and just kind of enjoying that for the novelty to them and then how the students respond to it, because, you know, we're often doing something fun or at least creative or interesting, learning about each other, creating something together, that sort of thing. And so I feel pretty lucky, but I'm also a part of Facebook groups where, and, you know, on Twitter as well, people talk about the observations that they've had. And, you know, how different it can be based on who you are and what you're doing and who your observer is and what their relationship to classroom teaching is or to world language teaching. I'm thinking of the first kind of thing that comes to mind a lot is that with teachers who use comprehension-based communicative language teaching are often acting as the input provider for their classes. They're narrating, they're describing, they're showing students, they're modeling the language, they're just communicating with students, but they are like the language parent sometimes, you know, guiding and offering the correct nutritional language that's needed at the time. And that can look to the untrained eye as very teacher-centered. And I think in conversations, if that comes up, it's important to define what teacher center means to the person who's saying it and then to you as well. Because I would argue that so many of our classes, the curricula we follow or the kind of activities that people share, the way things are done, are very student centered because it's putting their comprehension front and center. It's putting their interests front and center, the personalization, their ability to decide details and stories, the ability to share things about their lives, to share their opinions and experiences. Is very student-centered, but because of the fundamental role of input and the position of the teacher to provide lots of really good, concentrated, comprehensible input to students, it can look like the teacher is doing all the work when really the kids are, their brains are doing tons of work. And so it is a student-centered environment. It's just directed by the teacher.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that, but it's reminds me of, yeah, like we're student-centered, teacher-led. And, you know, I'm sure we've all had our fair share of bad observation experiences. I know that there was a teacher on one of the big Facebook groups years ago. I don't even remember when it was, but they had been teacher of the year for their state. Very well known, doing great things, and they got ineffective on their evaluation. And they made a big post about it, talking about it. And that was kind of like a real big shift for me too. Like, if I'm seeing this person and they're a great teacher, they're sharing great ideas, and they're getting ineffective, like, what's that say about the rubric? Maybe we're looking at the wrong things. So I know for me, or not for me necessarily, but at the Indiana TCI meetings, we have been talking the past couple times about input-based activities that look like output, because that's what administrators think they want to see. So things like quiz trade.
Mm-hmm.
If you're unfamiliar with it, it's a Kagan structure, so you can find out more information on the Kagan website. But students have little pieces of paper that have questions on them. And then on the backside of the paper, there's like maybe a sentence starter. And so students go around, you can do this as like personalized questions. You can do this to review, make them comprehension questions. And students just go around, they find a partner, and then ask each other the question. They give each other the support on the back of the paper if they need it. Then they switch papers and find a new partner. And then they'll just go around and do this for a while. So a lot of it is really input-based, especially depending on what the sentence stem is, or you can give them options on it. But it looks like output. It looks like communication. But is it really? Which I don't know if that even matters when it comes to observations. I know that if I'm giving an input-based activity that looks like output, then I'm doing my job of making students get input. But then I'm also doing the part of my job that says, hey, this is what your class should look like. So,
And I think something that comes up a lot on the topic of observations is the idea of like rigor. And like administrators expect a certain level of rigor, and it means doing XYZ type of activity. And it's really just about them not being educated about our field, which if you have to, you know, manage all subjects at your school is kind of understandable. But at the same time, like, I think we do need to have conversations with our administrators about what rigor looks like in comprehension-based classrooms. And really, like, the students know if they have to concentrate really hard on what you're saying and figuring out what it means and what they're reading and what it means, like, they are very cognitively engaged, and it is a rigorous course, and maybe even more than some other classes that they're taking during that. But the administrator who's just popping in, you know, for, I don't know, however long they are coming in, and then they're not there every day, they don't know that necessarily. So I think it is, a lot of it is being, if you have the ability to do so, a lot of school contexts are different, but if you can be proactive in any kind of way about discussing, like, this is how you know students are engaged and how you know students are doing hard work in my class.
Yeah. And just one last thing, I think, on like the topic of what should language classes look like? What does rigor look like in the language classroom? John Cower has a great blog on it. Instead of using the word rigor, uses the words mental lift or mental effort, something like that. Because, I mean, look at some other content areas where they think just more work is rigor rather than like the depth of the work. So just because it looks like they're doing stuff doesn't really mean that they're doing anything. But also, just because it looks like they're not doing anything doesn't mean that they're...
Smart thing to throw in, because that does look good, and you also can plan such that leading up to that, they've received so much input on those topics that they're ready, you know, in some degree to do that. But I think there are little adjustments we can make too that maybe will help too, like I don't know, a graphic organizer, you know what I mean? And maybe it's just like, if you're doing a story, you have like a story mountain, and then you're like, look at the cross-curricular with ELA. We talked about the story mountain, or like a five-fingered retell. Again, if you did that together as a class, you're using a structure that like shows the thinking in this like very visible way, but also allows you to just kind of, you know, keep giving rich input in the thing you're doing. Or, you know, if any sort of, if you're teaching about content or, you know, something from the target culture, same thing, like finding a graphic organizer that works for that, maybe a cultural comparison, a la the AP exam or blah, 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 you know, like whatever it is. Do you have any activities that you have used during observations that your observer was like, holy cow, how neat? The first one that comes to mind, literally from the opening, I have worked in schools before where standing at the door when students come in the door is like a big, is like a thing you have to do. And then I worked in schools where that is not the norm. And if people do it, then it's just kind of their own choice. And I asked for a class password and for some reason was able to talk about how that is almost like an SEL check because you're kind of getting an emotional read on the kid before they even come in the room. And they're learning a useful phrase in the target language. And it starts them off on getting into the rigorous mindset of the class. You know what I mean? Like you can just kind of connect it to so many different things. But that was one of the first things when my administrator was like, I love that they were talking German before they even entered the classroom. And I was like, yes. What other things have you had that your administrators have been like, when your kids did that? Wow, that sure was an absolute banger.
Surprisingly, mine really enjoyed brain breaks. Which I, you know, wouldn't the topic of rigor is like, oh, I didn't think that was the part you would comment on, but she's like, oh yeah, I love that they're like, you know, doing exercise in French, like, you know, giving them commands and they have to listen and, you know, do it and whatever. I'm like, cool, great. How about the rest of my lesson? I mean, yeah, like that is something that they may not see necessarily in other content areas. I know, especially in comprehension based language teaching, that's something that people use frequently. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like it's something that's a little different.
I think for me, my go-to observation or demonstration lesson is movie talk. I think it's usually something that I can do really well to show off my skill as a teacher, but also a way to get students involved a lot. So I think also what tends to happen in observations is I ask a lot more questions, which is maybe something that I need to just like work on anyway, but I get a lot more student interaction because I'm asking more questions because I know that's what I should be doing anyway.
Isn't that supposed to be the point? Maybe movie talk. I was thinking movie talk was like, now my brain is in this, like, how can we connect it to other content areas? But like you could do things like predictions and opinions and just, you know what I mean? Like so many things that are skills that English teachers and other reading teachers are trying to give to their kids as well could come up very naturally with that. You're telling a story, right? Interesting. Another one that my observer was also like, amazing, is they give a 4-question quick quiz. I don't know if the one in question was just like a true false quick quiz or if it was like, I asked the question and then the kids write the answer. My observer was like, formative assessment, boy. And I was like, yeah, Diva, I formatively assessed that. And then I can see who struggled and who didn't. And so I think in conclusion about administrator observations, you need to maybe proactively educate your administrator about what they're going to see. Bryce Hedstrom has an administrator checklist that you might hand to them and say, these are the things that I look for in my teaching. Would you be interested in looking for them for me as well? And so maybe you do that proactive thing. Maybe turning comprehension-based activities into something more administrator or observationally palatable or something like that, or, you know, just relying on certain things. So yeah, for many, it can be a box to check. I'm hoping for your sake, listener, that it is an opportunity for growth that's fun and cool. But if you have to check the box, then learn what they want and there are ways to get there. Brainstorm with your colleagues. That has helped me a lot in that regard.
And just really quickly, like I remembered that someone has talked about like having a student job be like the reader, or like whenever someone comes in to observe, they explain what you're doing because it may look really different from what they're seeing in other classes, even other language classes. So it's like, you know, when an adult that is not you comes in, they'll greet them in the target language and say, this is what we're doing. We usually do this kind of thing. And, you know, just kind of sit to show them that they understand what's going on. I think that's something that administrators look for too, that students know what the objectives of your lessons are. So it's just an idea.
Totally. Love. Let's un-gatekeep some research about observations. For this episode, we read a great title, A Focus on Quality of Teaching in Schools Increases Students' Progress of Attainment, period. Evidence from English Secondary Schools. By Roland Bernhardt et al. What was the effect of administrator observations that were evaluative and then peer observations? So teachers observing each other's lessons for professional development purposes, not for evaluative purposes. And if schools did one or the other, what did that do? You, Bill and Brian, how many times a year would you say you get observed by your administrator?
We do it twice. We have one informal and one formal that's planned. And it used to be in my district that the formal was 3 full lessons in a row, and we have 90-minute block periods. So you can imagine like the possible stress attached with that. And now I think they've knocked it down to 2 this year, but still it's a pretty intense process. But it is like specifically like 2 times throughout the year.
Bill's counting in his head.
We are in the process of creating a process.
Oh, so come on, independent school.
I was observed twice my first year here and haven't been since.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I think because you work in an independent school though, right? Yeah. And so I think it's part of public school law. I mean, Brian and Bill are nodding.
Yeah, in my public school life, we had 2 short observations, which were like 15-minute pop-ins, and 1 long observation, which had to be at least half an hour, I think. And that one had like pre-conference, post-conference.
Yeah. So I'm forgetting because in Washington or in my district, there's a difference between being on, quote, comprehensive and focus. In comprehensive, they get the whole rubric. My current district uses Danielson. My previous district used the Self-5D from the University of Washington. And so, obscure University of Washington reference. I think it's University of Washington. Please, I hope I didn't misquote this speak. Anyways, all being said is that it was you're on focus or on comprehensive, they do the whole thing. You get an evaluations in each indicator. And then after you've been at your school for X amount of years, you get put on focus and then you get to pick essentially indicators or they get picked for you essentially. Or I think this year it's even just that I'm being held accountable for my student growth goals and kind of demonstrating the evidence related to that. And then after a certain amount of years on focus, you get back on comprehensive. All that being said, it sounds like I'm getting observed, I think 2 or 3 times this year. So it sounds like we're all kind of in the same neighborhood. And for me, they're quite spread out. And so it's hard to tell the narrative story to my evaluator about like what happened in the meantime, because, you know, maybe I'll get one observation. I'm having mine tomorrow, actually. And then who knows when the next one, because it's not on the calendar yet. So yeah, welcome to PQA. Next question is, how often do you get the chance to, or does your school set up for you to, or do you just go out on your own to do peer observations, like observations of other people teaching language or even, you know, content area classes? Mm-hmm.
It is required as part of our evaluation process. We have to peer observe.
Ooh,
I think is great, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
I read an article about this.
And I think it is just one lesson, though. But like, you do have to like write a report of what you saw and stuff. So.
Wow. Okay. That is very accountable.
At my school, we have learning communities. And last year, the one that I was part of was peer observation. And this is like a self-selected group. So if you don't want to do it, you're signing up for a different group. So I signed up for the peer observation one last year, and it was a really good time. We spent time once a month or so talking about what we're looking for in peer observation. And then we used the time to set up when we could observe each other. Last year was more, I think, about building the process of it, but it was really fun. Something that I tried to do, and then maybe I'll try to revive this at some point, was I made a list of what I thought were some comprehension-based communicative language teaching skills and did a little form to send out to colleagues being like, hey, what is it that you're really good at? And when are you teaching or going to be doing something with that skill so that I can come and watch and learn from you? On the other side of that, we could also use the form like, hey, I'm working on this. Could you come see how I'm doing with it and give me any pointers? Something that's really important, I think, with peer observation, especially if it's like of your own volition to go and watch someone, is discuss what, if any, feedback the person wants. And I think you need to think about whether you're observing to learn from someone or if you're learning to try to evaluate them. And I think especially if you say, hey, can I come watch you do this skill that I'm working on? You're not giving them feedback. That's not why you're going in that case.
Yeah.
And also, and we'll talk about this more in a little bit, I think, but like, think about how to change your feedback into feed forward. Mm-hmm. Not like, hey, you did this and this and this bad. How about like, hey, next time, maybe when you're trying to do this, try this other thing out. Like, if we know when we do something that doesn't work, like, we don't need anyone else telling us that. Like, yeah, I know that I talked too quickly there and didn't ask enough comprehension questions. You don't need to tell me that. I was also there.
Yeah, I think setting up a context for the observation is important, because I'd be loath to give a peer feedback if they were not asking for it. And then just like, you know, people might be looking for certain sorts of things. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's why I am not at a school now where peer observation is part of the school culture. I previously was given, actually by my evaluator, like release time and to go observe two teachers. And my evaluator was like, I would like you to work on these things, like these indicators within our observation protocol. And these two teachers do those things very well. So go observe them. So I got to observe my Spanish teacher colleague, which was wonderful. And then an English teacher who did a pretty good job of unpacking kind of the learning standards in a very kid-friendly way. And that was really cool for me because, you know, they built that in, gave me the time to do it, you know, used the like invested school resources in making sure that I could learn from my peers. And it wasn't to tell my peers anything about their teaching. And, you know, I guess I could have, and just how much fun I had in general going to their class, but it was for that development, and those have stuck with me. And so I'm going to segue that into talking about this little article here. So big, a long title. It came about because Austrian schools, so schools in Austria, which is a country in the continent of Europe, no kangaroos there, unless they're in zoos, probably. This is the German teacher in me. I'm so sorry. Anyways, so in Austria, they were looking to improve their schools and were trying to look into what factors really help schools make big improvements. And so they looked at some schools in England to try to figure some secondary schools to try to figure out what schools had made the biggest growth and like progress. And they did that by very smartly controlling and kind of looking at prior achievement in students. So not taking like only top schools where kids were already coming in on the top and then staying on the top, but also schools that, where students were coming in, you know, not up to grade level standard or whatever, and moving and making more progress than one would expect. And so they're looking for, what are the schools, what are the institutions that are really, you know, giving kids more years of learning than they have on the clock, right? Yeah. The collective efficacy of the school. Indeed. So, to that end, they did a bunch of questionnaires to administrators of these schools, but then also to the staff of the schools, you know, so I think it's good to kind of talk to everybody involved in the school enterprise to figure out how things are really going. And so they, you know, saw how many times people were getting observed by their administrators in an evaluative sense, how many times teachers were doing lesson studies or observing other teachers' lessons, and did some very complex statistical finagling. The middle part of the article is a lot of stats stuff about what they did to figure out what were the positive correlations, what were indicators that a school was going to make really great progress. So what were the findings? Yeah, we had just had a bunch of different schools, fairly diverse schools in terms of socioeconomic and then prior achievement and sort of stuff like that, controlled for quite a few factors. And what were the findings? The finding is that schools where there were lots of progress made, part of that came from the administration, who said that quality of teaching was like one of the most important things that you needed to work on. And so that the school focused on the quality of their teaching and had conversations about what quality teaching looked like, define those things. It's like when we talk about teaching having clearly defined lesson goals, did the administrators have teaching goals for the whole school, teaching and learning goals? And what do those look like? Parent-school relationships were also a fairly good indicator of student progress, that there's lots of communication back and forth. So that might be something to work on. In looking closely at classroom observations, the qualitative study that they had done previous to this one made it sound like it's the amount of observations period is accountable for XYZ achievement. When the quantitative study that is this one we've read was that peer observations by other teachers are actually what indicated the greatest progress for students in their learning and their outcomes. And was specifically with a note, I'm just going to read because I have it right in front of me. Our study supports the notion that peer observation for professional development rather than evaluation purposes may be a particularly worthwhile school-based strategy for supporting student progress. And so all that to say is that, you know, people get different various levels of lucky when it comes to their observations for their teaching, you know, the legal observations, you know, those ones, the required ones for evaluation by an evaluator. Maybe your evaluator taught a language. Maybe they didn't. Maybe your evaluator taught, period. Maybe they didn't. And so I think everyone gets something slightly different out of those experiences. A surefire way to kind of fire up your professional learning and the growth of your students in your classroom is to invest in peer observations and to invest in the time it takes to go observe a peer and then debrief or think about it, process what you saw, the literal money dollars that it takes to, you know, hire a sub, a rotating sub who goes and relieves teachers for one period each and so that they can go do peer observations. Maybe that's how your school funds that sort of thing. And also the mindset that it takes at the school that teachers watch each other teach because we like what we do and we want to do it better. And we know that there are people in our building who are experts at some things and are working on other things. And by lifting each other up, collective, then we all come, all the boats rise. And that only stands to benefit our students, period. Does anyone in the class have a comment on the study?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not really surprising to me. I feel that the most valuable professional development that I've done has been watching other teachers teach. And I'm feeling validated a little bit because I wasn't sure if I was going to get into this later, but I'm talking about it now. But at my previous school, when I was department chair, I instituted a department exchange program, which is basically peer observations. And I like created this little timetable with like everyone's schedule. And I was like, okay, sign up to go see two different teachers. Because luckily I was supported at that school by my principal to hire subs if necessary. So we really could go see whichever class we wanted. At my current school, we do have to observe, but it has to be during our prep period. So it's kind of whatever you can define. And I gave the teachers kind of like an observation little worksheet sort of thing to do, or mostly just for taking notes. What do they see? But I did include some specific like comprehension based communicative language teaching focused things. Like, did you see them, you know, talking slow, making themselves comprehensible, asking lots of different personalized questions, things like that. And it wasn't for I didn't want them to evaluate each other. It was just for the teachers themselves to like kind of reflect on the experience and consider like what, if anything, they would implement in their own classroom. So yay me. And if you have the ability to do that, I think this article gives you some fuel for your fire to let you do that. So.
I'm department chair this year. And now I'm already like, wait a minute, we have departmental days that can be used for subs to go to professional development, stuff like that. Why not bring the professional development in-house? The call is coming from inside the house, the professional house, which is a school. Absolutely. I love that. Departmental exchange. That's really fun too. It makes it seem like you're going on a trip.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, we're going on a trip. It's down the hall.
Well, Ben, thanks for unlocking that gate. All right. How about we move on to Girl Boss and let's chat a little bit about how observations have been successful or what we have found to be successful in observation, in feedback, and whatnot. Would like to start off by talking about one of the methods of observation that I personally really enjoy, which is the coaching model, which has been founded and modified by a lot of different people in a lot of different places. You'll see the coaching model be implemented in summer conferences and sometimes at little TCI get-togethers, regional groups, and whatnot. Coaching essentially is a way for participants at a conference to try out new skills and act as if they are teaching a class, but the students are all other conference participants. You set it up so that the students are perfect little baby angels, like the best students that you could ever be. That way the teacher who's practicing can focus just on the skill rather than, say, classroom management. Usually we'll practice circling or asking strategic questions. You can check out episode 2 if you haven't so yet, to check out our episode on question asking strategies. We'll start with a sentence and we'll have them practice asking a bunch of different questions about the statement. There's also a row of observers. There aren't students, they're just watching the teacher. The students are acting as students, so they're just trying to learn language. When we wrap everything up, we ask 3 questions. We say, how did the teacher keep things comprehensible? How did they connect with the students? And what was the communicative purpose?
I love that. I think that's so essential. I mean, I'm rereading, I think I've said it in previous podcasts, I'm rereading Common Ground right now. And I'm like, why are we doing this? What are we doing? Like, what is the purpose? Like, what are people going to do with this information? And I think that's really smart to re-include
it. Yeah. And I think it also like led us to just think more deeply about what is our communicative purpose for a particular activity. But we also, thanks to one of our favorite people, Dr. Diane Neubauer, who has been sharing a lot about like language play as a form of communication. And I'm sure I'm oversimplifying that. She's done an episode on her podcast about what it kind of looks like. And we used to maybe call it like the communicative purpose of it was maybe entertainment. So story asking, the communicative purpose is like, oh, we're just like creating with language and having a good time. They need to understand me because I want them to have a good time. Or like, you know, informational, they're learning something, or like social, you're learning about each other. So I really like that kind of like follow-up questions with, or at least like reflection questions. And then I, as a coach, try to get the teacher to reflect on maybe like where they would go next. We try to keep the whole experience like positive for every single person involved. So we don't, what was the phrase? I learned it from someone. We don't should all over each other. You like, you don't tell someone like, you should have done this, you should have done that. Like I said earlier, especially in like a 5-minute teaching demo in front of other adults, you know when you messed up. You don't need anyone like bringing it back up. Like that just doesn't do anything really to help move the person forward. But what we want to do is like highlight and reinforce the positive skills that they're showing so that we continue to do those things. And fun fact, when you start getting good at things and start doing them more, you're going to start pushing out maybe some of the less effective practices. So keep it positive.
I think that
keep it really like comprehensible, connected, and communicative. And then for the teacher side of reflection, and then, you know, like highlight what people do well.
I think that's super important because the change to comprehension-based teaching and communicative language teaching for a lot of teachers represents like a huge shift in the way that they think about their role, in the way that they think about the things they do in the classroom. And so it can feel like if you go to a conference and you see somebody who is very charismatic or outgoing or loud, that if you're not that, or if you have those things but in different measure, that you like can't do the things that they do. And so your class won't be as enjoyable. It won't be as like blah, it won't be blah, 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 whatever. And I think that coaching has been very powerful for people in my local TCI PLC to see that they have skills that are working towards those goals of comprehensibility, of making students feel connected and welcome and warm, even if they're not, you know, doing cartwheels and you know, putting on mini plays every single lesson, right? So I think that emphasizing the positive in that coaching format is so important. I learned a similar format as you did, Bill, from Lori Clark via email. Her and I were emailing back and forth. I was like, how do I do this? And we implemented it in my local PLC, and it was so powerful. Again, people bring a lot of strengths to the table. Comprehension-based teaching looks so many different ways with so many different personalities, activity types and stuff. You just have to find what makes it work for you. And focusing on positives is so important for that. But I think that speaks also to like having a what you're looking for. Like when you're going into a peer observation, like what are you looking for? What do you hope to learn from it? And I think the Bryce Hedstrom's administrator checklist that I mentioned earlier, I think would be good for any teacher that for any sort of thing. But if you're wanting to do this for yourself, you might also use the one put out by the Comprehensible Classroom. They have some really nice peer observation sheets that help you kind of process what you're seeing in terms of comprehension-based teaching skills. If your department needs something to unify around, you could use one of those. You could use something, the TEL project, the Teacher Effectiveness in Language Learning, which has a variety of tools to help you reflect on different aspects of language teaching and learning. And that, you know, if everyone's speaking a common language, then you'll understand each other. But it'll make it clear what you're looking for, and it can help spark conversation. Sometimes it feels like if you're not talking about the same thing with other teachers, it tells you you're like right by each other, you know, that like, you know, if a teacher does an activity type that you don't do anymore for whatever reason, then it can be like, well, we got nothing. But, you know, you have to find the commonalities out ahead of time or say, you know, these are the sorts of things you might look for in an observation. That can make it more powerful for everybody. I would say too, an additional thing for me that has been very powerful is because I was trying to learn about communicative comprehension-based language teaching, and I didn't anybody in my area who was doing that. I didn't have the resources to get to anyone who was doing that. Although Adriana Ramirez, who is an absolute boss of CCLT, technically lives right up the road. I just could not get up to Canada to like take days off work to go see her live in person. And so instead, there are some teachers who post a lot of their lessons online. I have watched many, many, perhaps hours of Adriana teaching from the comfort and privacy of my own classroom and or home, and use the same observation protocols on those videos to try to figure out how she was making the language comprehensible, how she was making the students feel connected and warm and engaged. And then I think also, you know, starting to think about communicative purpose, that would be a nice added twist as well. And so if you are having a hard time observing peers because you're admin isn't giving you money, or your department is even hostile to that for, you know, maybe they have a historical beef with how evaluations are done or something, you know, whatever it is, you can go watch other teachers via YouTube. And so some ones that I've watched that were super influential for me were Adriana Ramirez. I watched a lot of Elena Filipescu. I watched Sarah Breckley. I've watched, who else have I watched on there? Cecile Lene, Tina Hargaden, watching them do their lessons. Have been really influential for me in giving me those skills, those things that we're looking for that make language teaching work. And inevitably having to adapt them for myself is also really powerful. Brian, did you have another take on another thing you might do in this regard?
I would definitely recommend, like, if possible at any point, like observing a teacher who teaches the language that you don't speak. Because then it kind of gets you out of your own head. Because I think like when you're observing someone who teaches the same language and subject and level or whatever as you, you're really like, well, I would do that, but I wouldn't do that. And like, I don't think I can, you know, see myself doing that. And like, you're just kind of like really kind of, but like, if you are as if you're brand new learning the language, because you actually are, that gives you the opportunity to focus a lot more on like, how is the teacher making this comprehensible? Am I understanding it? It's authentic. You know? And it puts you again in the shoes of a student and how your own students would feel in your own classroom a lot easier, I think. So yeah, even if it's not something super formal, if you're just watching videos online, I definitely recommend doing that.
At a conference where we were taking a Korean class together from Janet Sunsangnim, and that was, again, like to be step zero in your language learning is so powerful to learn those skills again, and such valuable PD.
It's hands down, I think, the most influential thing for me is to be a student again. But I think that's a topic for another time. Because, but yeah, watching each other is really important, I think. I'm trying to get a swivel, which is like a robot tripod, and you wear like this like necklace thing and it turns with you, which I just a little bit more beneficial than trying to set up a camera in the back and get the back of all the kids' heads. So like actually have something that can like follow.
I used one for my teacher of the year portfolio, and it was very helpful because it's also a little mic. Yeah. Brian, our listeners can't hear, but Brian's in the chat being like, or have a child follow you around and record you. Totally. I mean, yeah, fair. If you have a TA, make it.
I'm suggesting that you don't do that because they, unfortunately, angels that they are not the best videographers. So yeah, if you can use something else, I would recommend that.
I think the moral of the story is that trying to be a reflective teacher is so important in general that is positively correlated with greater success for your students is building time into your teacherly life to reflect on what went well about your lessons and where you go next from there. But I think nothing puts in starker release more the things that we do, the micro skills, the macro choices and curricular choices and minute to minute and second to second choices more than watching another teacher do your job, not your specific job, but the job that you do generally, and watching them go through the same processes as you and using it to question or maybe affirm the choices that you make as well. So we're over here at Soleil, wishing your formal necessary evaluative observations go smoothly and that you find some time and space to observe a peer in your department, to observe a peer online, to observe yourself and grow from that experience. Go Slay.
Play all day.